Harbinger. One of a series of three calamities that engulfed most of Arb during the last decades of the Praxic Age and later came to be seen as precursors or warnings of the terrible events. The precise nature of the Harbingers is difficult to sort out because of destruction of records, many of which were stored on syntactic devices that later ceased functioning. But it is generally agreed that the first Harbinger was a worldwide outbreak of violent revolutions, the second was a world war, and the third was a genocide. The Dictionary, 4th edition, AR 3000.
"We have come," said the man in the robes. "We have answered your call."
He was speaking Orth, not as well as Jules Verne Durand, but well enough to make me think he had been studying it for a couple of years, as long as we didn't snow him with arcane tenses and intricate sentence structures, he would be able to keep up. I say we, but I didn't expect to do much talking. "Why am I here?" I had asked Fra Jad, as we had approached the gate of the building that floated in the center of Orb One.
"To serve as amanuensis," he had replied.
"These people can build self-sufficient intercosmic starships, but they don't have recording devices?"
"An amanuensis is more than a recording device. An amanuensis is a consciousness-bearing system, and so what it observes in its cosmos has effects in others in the manner we spoke of at Avershon's Dowment."
"You're a consciousness-bearing system, and you seem to be much better at playing this polycosmic chess game than I am, so doesn't that make me exiguous?"
"Much pruning has taken place in recent weeks. I am now absent in many versions of the cosmos where you are present."
"You mean you're dead and I'm alive?"
"Absent and present express it better, but if you insist on using those terms, I won't quibble."
"Fra Jad?"
"Yes, Fra Erasmus?"
"What happens to us after we die?"
"You already know as much of it as I do."
About then, the conversation had been interrupted as we had been ushered into the room, featuring the man in the robes. Knowing nothing of Arnudan culture put me at a disadvantage in trying to puzzle out who this man was. The room offered no clues. It was a sphere with a flat floor, like a smallish planetarium. I guessed that it was situated near the geometric center of the orb. The inner surface was matte and glowed softly with piped-in sunlight. The circular floor had a chair in the middle, surrounded by a ring-shaped bench. A few receptacles, charged with steaming fluids, were arranged on the bench. Otherwise, the room was featureless and undecorated. I felt at home here.
"We have answered your call."
What was Fra Jad going to say to that? A few possible responses strayed into my head. "Well, what took you so long?" Or, "What the hell are you talking about?" But Fra Jad answered in a shrewdly noncommittal way by saying,
"That I have come to bid you welcome."
The man turned sideways and extended an arm toward the circular bench. The robes unfurled and hung from his arm like a banner. They were mostly white, but elaborately decorated. I wanted to say that they were brocade or embroidery, but life among bolt-wearing ascetics had left me with a deeply impoverished vocabulary where the decorative arts were concerned, so I'll just say that they were fancy.
"Please,"
the man said.
"We have tea, a purely symbolic offering, since your bodies can do nothing with it, but..."
"We shall be pleased to drink your tea,"
Fra Jad said. So we repaired to the circular bench and took seats. I let Fra Jad and our host sit relatively close, facing each other, and arranged myself somewhat farther away. Our host picked up his teacup and made what I guessed was some kind of polite ceremonial gesture with it, which Fra Jad and I tried to copy. Then we all sipped. It was no worse and no better than what Javarn used to eat at Messel. I didn't think I'd be taking any home with me. The man drew some notes from a pocket in his robe and consulted them from time to time as he delivered the following.
"I am called Gan Odru. In the history of the Daban Ernud, I am the 43rd person to bear the title of Gan. Odru is my given name. The closest translation of Gan into Orth is Admiral. This only approximates its meaning. In our military system, one class of officers were responsible for the trees, another for the forest.
Tactics and strategy, respectively,
Fra Jad said.
Exactly. Gan was the highest-ranking strategic officer, responsible for direction of a whole fleet and reporting to civilian authorities when there were any. Command of specific vessels was delegated by the Gan to tactical officers with the rank of Prague, or what you would call a captain. I apologize for perhaps boring you with this, but it is a way to explain the manner in which the Daban Ernud has behaved toward Ab.
It is in no way boring,
said Fra Jad, and glanced over my way to verify that I was doing my job, which, as far as I could tell, was merely to remain conscious.
The first Gan of the Daban Ernud was entrusted with the responsibility to establish a colony on another star system,
Gan Odru continued.
As links to Ernud became more tenuous with distance, his responsibilities grew, and he became the supreme authority, answerable to no one. But he was a strange kind of Gan in that his fleet consisted of but one ship, and so his staff consisted of but one Prague, and inasmuch as the Prague had no real tactical decisions to make, as the war had been left far behind, the relationship between Gan and Prague became unstable and evolved. A simple way to express it is that the Gan became somewhat like your avowed, and the Prague like your secular power. This state of affairs came about over the course of but a single generation, but proved extraordinarily stable and has not changed since. The clothing that I wear is but little changed from the formal dress uniforms worn by the Gans of Ernud's ocean-going fleets thousands of years ago, though, of course, they did not wear them aboard ship, since it is difficult to swim in robes.
Humor was the last thing I was looking for here, and so astonishment got the better of mirth, and I chuckled too little and too late.
The second Gan was weakened by illness and served for only 6 years. The third was a young protege of the first. He had a long career, and through the force of his personality and his uncommon intelligence, gained back some of the power that his office had ceded to that of the Prags. Late in his career, he became aware of your summons and made the decision to alter the trajectory of the Daban Ernud so that it would, as he conceived it, fly into the past. For the signals that he and the others heard, they conceived as ancestral voices calling them home to make the Ernud that should have been, but that, through its leader's follies, it had failed to become. I suppose you have already some notion of the wanderings that followed, the advents at Tro, Earth, and Phthos, and their consequences. My purpose is not to rehearse all of that history, but to give an account of our actions here.
It will be useful,
Fra Jad said,
to know what occurred with the Warden of Heaven.
For a long time,
said Gan Odru, shifting into a lower gear, as he was now making it up as he went along instead of reading from notes.
The relationship between the Gans and the Prags has been poisoned. The Prags have said that the third Gan was simply wrong, that all the wanderings of the Daban Ernud have been without meaning, simply the endless consequence of an ancient mistake. Believing that, They saw their only purpose as self-preservation. Those who think this way want only to settle down somewhere and go on living. And with each advent, some do. We have left Ernudans behind on Tro, Troans behind on Earth, and so on. They find ways to live even though those Cosmai are not their own. So, of the cynical ones, the ones who believe it is all a meaningless error, a large fraction are bled off at each advent. At the same time, we are joined by ones from the new cosmos who believe in the quest. So the ship is rebuilt and departs for the next cosmos. At first, the Gons have power, and the Progs do their bidding. But the journey is long, the quest is forgotten as generations go by. The Progs gain, the Gons lose power. The pedestal and the fulcrum have long been our names for these two tendencies. And so here you see me, virtually alone in this place of ceremony, doing what my predecessors did, but with little respect and no power. Thus came we to Ab. Preg Eshwar, my counterpart, and her followers saw your planet as just another civilization to be raided for its resources, so that the ship could be rebuilt and the journey extended. Yet Eshwar is an intelligent woman who has read our histories and well knows that in an advent, the pedestal and the Prog tend to lose power to the fulcrum and the Gan. Already she was choosing tactics to forestall this. When the Warden of Heaven came to us, it was obvious that he was a fool, a charlatan. We already knew as much, of course, from our surveillance of Arb's popular culture. And the Prog had already devised a plan to draw comparisons between me and this Warden of Heaven, to make his foolishness, his falseness, rub off on me. So the Warden of Heaven was brought here in his spacesuit. He kept wanting to take it off. We advised against it. When he came into this room, he saw it as a kind of holy place, and insisted that the risk of removing his suit was acceptable, that his God would watch over him and keep him safe. So off came the suit. He became short of breath. Our physicians tried to reassemble the suit around him, but this did not help matters, for he had already suffered the bursting of a major blood vessel. The physicians next tried to put him in a cold hyperbaric chamber, a therapy in which they are well practiced. He was stripped naked and readied for the procedure, but it was too late. He died. A debate followed as to what should be done with the body. While some of us debated, overzealous researchers took samples of his blood and tissues and commenced an autopsy. So the body had already been desecrated, if you will. Prog Eshwar made the decision that any effort to apologize would be taken as a sign of weakness, and that any sharing of information would only benefit Ab. And two, for internal political reasons, she was inclined to show contempt, or at least disregard, for the body, because she had made it into a symbol for me. Hence the style in which the Warden of Heaven was returned.
But it backfired, I said. Didn't it?
Yes. Those of the Fulcrum were embarrassed and ashamed, and conceived a plan to make an exchange of blood for blood. As we had taken samples of blood from the Warden of Heaven's body, they would convey samples of our blood to the surface of Ab. We had detected signals from the planet, which, as we later learned, had been sent by Fra Orlo. These took the form of an analemma. Jules Verne Durand had become the foremost authority on Orth and on the Avout. He was covertly sympathetic to the fulcrum. He interpreted Orlo's signal as pointing to Ekba, and suggested that it would have profound symbolic value to deliver the samples there. He even volunteered to go down on the probe. But at about the same time, he was ordered to go on the raid to the consent of the Matterites, and so was no longer available. Lys went in his stead, without his knowledge, of course, for she had learned much of the Avowed and even a few words of Orth from Jules. It went wrong, and she was shot while boarding the probe, as you know.
We let a few moments pass, untroubled by words.
Since then, things have moved fast. I would say that Prageshwar has done what Prags do, which is...
React tactically, with no thought of strategy,
Jad said.
Yes, it led us to this pass. 31 have been slain by your Fras and Sors, from the Ringing Veil, I presume.
Fra Jad made no response, but Gon Odru looked my way and I nodded. He continued,
87 more are held hostage. Your colleagues herded them into a chamber and welded the doors shut.
A misinterpretation,
Fra Jad said.
Such people do not take hostages, so the 87 were put in that room to keep them safely out of the way.
Prageshwar interprets it, rightly or wrongly, as hostage-taking, and prepares a response with one hand. With her other hand, she has reached out to me and asked me to discuss matters with you. She is shaken. I don't really know why. The large bomb that was destroyed has always been a weapon of last resort. No one would seriously consider using it.
Pardon me, Gon Odru, but the pedestal was getting ready to launch it, I blurted.
As a threat, yes. To hang above your planet and exert pressure. But that is its only real use. I don't understand why its loss has shaken Prageshwar so deeply.
It didn't,
Fra Jad said.
Prageshwar sensed terrible danger.
How would you know this?
Gon Odru asked politely. Fra Jad ignored the question.
She might explain it by claiming that she had a nightmare, or that sudden inspiration struck her in the bath, or that she has a gut feeling that tells her she ought to steer a safer course.
And is this something that you brought about?
Gon Odru said, more as exclamation than as question. He was getting very little satisfaction from Fra Jad, and so turned to look at me. I can't guess what he saw on my face. Some mix of bemusement and shock, for I had just seen a glimpse of an alternative narrative in which we had visited appalling destruction upon one of the orbs.
That we might send a signal to Prageshwar. Is that such a difficult thing to believe for you, Gon Odru, the heritor of a tradition? 1,000 years old, founded on the belief that my predecessors summoned you hither?
I suppose not. But it is so easy, after all this time, to harbor doubts, to think of it as a religion whose god has died.
It is good to doubt it, Fra Jad said. After all, the Warden of Heaven's mistake was failure to doubt. But one must choose the target of one's doubt with care. Your third Gon detected a flow of information from another cosmos, and saw it as cryptic messages from his ancestors. Your Progs ever since have doubted both halves of the story. You disbelieve only one half, that the signal came from your ancestors. But you may still believe that the signal exists while discarding the third Gon's incorrect notions as to its source. Believe, then, that information, the Hylian flow, passes between cosmi.
But if I may ask, have you learned the power to modulate that signal, to send messages thus?
I was all ears, but Fra Jad said nothing. Gan Odru waited for a few moments, then said,
I suppose we've already established that, haven't we? You apparently got inside Prog Eshwar's head somehow.
What signal did the third Gan receive 9 centuries ago? I asked.
A prophecy of terrible devastation. Robed priests massacred, churches torn down, books burning.
What gave him the idea it was from the past?
The churches were enormous. The books, written in unfamiliar script. On some of their burning leaves were geometrical proofs unknown to us, but later verified by our theors. On Urnud, we had legends of a lost, mythic golden age. He assumed that he was being given a window into it.
But what he was really seeing was the third sack, I said.
Yes, so it seems,
said Gan Odru.
And my question is, did you send us the visions, or did it just happen?
We have come. We have answered your call. Was he the last priest of a false religion? Was he no different from the Warden of Heaven?
The answer is not known to me, said Fra Jad.
He turned to look at me.
You shall have to search it for yourself.
What about you? I asked him.
I am finished here,
Fra Jad said. Part 12. Requiem. Something was pressing hard against my back, accelerating me forward. That couldn't be good. No, it was just gravity, or some reasonable facsimile, pulling me down against some flat, firm thing. I was monstrously cold. I started to shiver.
Pulse and respiration are looking more normal, said a voice in Orth. Blood oxygenation coming up.
Jules was translating this into some other language.
Core temp is getting into a range compatible with consciousness.
That would, perhaps, be my consciousness they were talking about. I opened my eyes. The glare faded. I was in a small but nice enough room. Jules Verne Durand was seated on the edge of my bed, looking clean and sleek. This, more than anything else, confirmed the vague impression that a lot of time had passed. I was hooked up to a bunch of stuff. A tube was cinched under my nose, blowing something cold, dry, and sweet into my nostrils. A physician, from Arb, was glancing back and forth between me and a Jija. A woman in a white coat, a Lateran, was looking on, running a big piece of equipment that was circulating warm water to... Well, you wouldn't believe me if I told you, and then you'd wish I'd kept such details to myself.
You have questions, my friend, Jules said, but perhaps you should wait until...
He's fine, said the Arbran.
He was dressed in a bolt and cord. He had a tube strapped across his upper lip. He shifted his attention to me.
You're fine, as far as I can tell. How do you feel?
Unbelievably cold.
That'll change. Do you know your name?
Fra Erasmus of Edhar.
Do you know where you are?
I would guess on one of the orbs on the Daban Urnud, but there are some things I don't understand.
I am Fra Sildanik of Rambolf, said the physician, and I need to tend to your comrades. I need Jules to come with me as interpreter.
and Dr. Guo here to supervise the core warming procedure. Speaking of which, we'll be needing that.
Dr. Guo now punctuated this statement in the most dramatic way you can possibly imagine by reaching up under my blankets from the foot of the bed and disconnecting me from the core warmer. For the first time in a long time, I uttered a religious oath.
Sorry,
said Fra Sildonic.
I'll live.
So
we are going to have to leave your questions unanswered,
Fra Sildonic continued.
But one is waiting outside who will, I think, be happy to lay it all out for you.
They left. Through the opening door, I glimpsed a pleasant view over open water, with green growing things all over the place, soon blocked by a small figure coming in at speed. A moment later, Ayla was lying full length on top of me, sobbing. She sobbed and I quivered. The opening half hour was all about raising my core temp and getting her calmed down. We made a great team that way. Ayla was just what the doctor ordered as a way to raise my temperature, and using me as a mattress seemed to be good for what ailed her. During the bone-breaking shivering that hit its peak about 15 minutes in, she clung to me as if I were an amusement park ride and kept me from vibrating right off the bed. This kind of thing gave way, in due course, to other fascinating biological phenomena, which I can't set down here without turning this into a different kind of document.
Okay, she finally said. I'll report to Fra Sildonic that you have excellent blood flow to all of your extremities.
It was the first complete sentence that had come out of her mouth. We had been together for an hour and a half. I laughed.
I was thinking heaven, but heaven wouldn't have these.
I tugged gently at the hissing tube under her nose. She snorted and batted my hand away.
Oxygen from Arb? I asked.
Obviously.
How did it, and you, get here?
She sighed, seeing that I was determined to ask tedious questions. She pushed herself up, straddled me. I raised my knees, and she leaned back against them. Snatched a pillow, propped herself up, got comfortable, fiddled with her oxygen tube. She looked at me, and once again the I'm in heaven hypothesis floated to the top. But it couldn't be. You had to deserve heaven.
After you went up, she said, the pedestal rotted all of our space launch infrastructure.
I'm aware of it.
Oh, yes, I forgot. You had a vantage point. So we got the message that they were extremely cross with us over the 200 missile launch. But they had fallen for the decoy, the inflatable thing you launched. They sent us detailed phototypes of the wreckage. Were they ever triumphant?
Maybe they were only pretending to fall for it.
We considered that, but remember a few days later, you guys were able to just walk right in.
Well, it was a little more difficult than you make it sound. I was trying to laugh, but it was hard with her weight on my tummy.
I get that, she said immediately. But what I'm trying to say is...
The pedestal hadn't taken any extraordinary precautions, I agreed. They were totally surprised.
Yes. So, one moment, they are feeling triumphant. The next, out of nowhere, all of a sudden, their world burner has been wrecked. A bunch of their people are dead. One of the 12 vertices has been seized by Arbran commandos.
Wow. The Veilers did all that?
They sneaked onto the world burner and planted 3 of the 4-shaped charges they had with them. Then they headed for a certain window.
Pardon me, a window?
That vertex is a sort of command post and maintenance depot for all things World Burner. There is a conference room with windows that look out over the bomb. Osa and company had a plan, apparently, to rendezvous there. Along the way, they were noticed and came under assault by the maintenance workers who were out there in spacesuits. But the workers didn't have weapons, per se.
Neither did the Veilers, I said.
She gave me a sort of pitying look,
maybe with a trace of affection.
Okay, I said. Veilers don't need weapons. The geometer's spacesuits are soft. Ours are hard. Just imagine.
Okay, I said. I'd almost rather not, but I can see how it would come out.
Survey died. She took on 5 guys, one of whom happened to be carrying a plasma cutter. It's a very unpleasant story. She and the 5 all ended up dead. But largely because of her intervention, the other 3 Veilers made it to that window. She paused for a moment, letting me absorb that. I had really hated Surveille when she had sewn me up after Masht, but when I remembered that picnic table surgery now, it made me want to cry. Once we had given Surveille a decent moment of silence, Ayla went on. So imagine this from the point of view of the big bosses inside the conference room. They see a large number of their people converted to floating corpses before their eyes. There's nothing they can do about it. Fra Osa trudges right up to the window and slaps on a shaped charge right up against the glass. They're not certain what it is. He makes a gesture. The world burner explodes in 3 places: the primary detonator, the inertial guidance system, and the propellant tanks. There is a huge secondary detonation as the tanks rupture.
That we noticed.
Fra Gratho is killed by a piece of flying debris.
Oh, damn it.
My eyes were stinging.
He stood between me and a bullet.
I know, she said softly. After another silence, she went on. So the bosses now understand the nature of the object that's been slapped on their window. They get the message and open an airlock. Esma comes inside. Osa stays where he is. He's the gun to their heads. Esma stays in her suit. She herds all the geometers she can find into the conference room, locks the door, welds it shut with St. Loy's powder. Now Osa joins her, bringing the shaped charge with him. They lock the doors into the vertex, sealing it off from the rest of the Dabanernud, and weld those too. They detonate the 4th charge in such a way that most of the vertex vents its atmosphere to space. Now it can't be approached except by people in spacesuits. They hole up in one of the few rooms that still has an atmosphere. Their suits are out of air now, so they climb out of them and suffer the usual symptoms.
What is up with that, by the way?
She shrugged. Hemoglobin is a classy molecule, finely tuned to do what it does. Take oxygen from the lungs and get it to every cell in the body. If you give it oxygen that is only a little bit different from what it's used to, well, it still works, just not as well. It's like being at high altitude. You get short of breath, woozy, can't think straight.
Hallucinations?
Maybe. Why, did you hallucinate?
Never mind. But wait a second. Jules can get along just fine on Arb air.
You acclimatize. Your body responds by generating more red blood cells. After a week or two, you can handle it. So, as an example, some of the people who live on Dabanernud rarely leave their home orb. They have trouble going into common areas of the ship where the air is a mixture. Others are used to it.
Like the Phothosian cosmographer who let us in the airlock at the observatory.
Exactly. When she saw you guys gasping for breath and starting to lose consciousness, she recognized what was going on, sounded an alarm.
She did? I said.
She gave me that pitying but affectionate look again. What, you were hoping you'd managed to sneak aboard?
I thought we had done exactly that.
She grabbed my hand and kissed it. I think your ego can be satisfied by what you did accomplish, which people are going to be celebrating for a long time.
Okay, I said, feeling it was time to change the subject away from my ego. She sounded an alarm.
Yes. Of course, there were lots of other alarms going off at the same time because of the Veiler's mayhem, Ayla said. But some medics came to the observatory and found you unconscious, but alive. Fortunately for you, the physicians around here are used to dealing with such problems. They put you on oxygen, which seemed to help, but they had no way to be sure. They'd never treated Arbrans. They were worried you were going to suffer brain damage. Better safe than sorry. So they put you on ice in a hyperbaric chamber.
On ice?
Yeah, literally. Dropped your body temperature to limit brain damage while oxygenating your blood as best they could with Lateran air. You've been unconscious for a week.
What about Osa and Desma? Hold up in that vertex.
She let a long moment pass before saying,
Well, Raz, they died. The Ernudans figured out where they were, blew a hole in the wall. All the air escaped into space. I lay there for a minute.
Well, I finally said,
I guess they went out like real Veilers.
Yes. I laughed in a not funny way. And, like a true non-Veiler, I lived.
And I'm glad you did.
And here she started crying again. It wasn't sadness over the dead Veilers, nor joy that the rest of us had lived. It was shame and hurt that she had sent us into a situation where we easily could have died, that the responsibilities placed on her shoulders and the logic of the situation had left her no alternative to the terrible decision. For the rest of her life, of our life, I hoped, she'd be waking up, sweaty, in the middle of the night over this. But it was a hurt she'd have to keep to herself, since most people she might share it with would not extend her much sympathy. You sent your friends to do what? While you sat on the ground, safe? So it was going to be a private thing between us, I knew, forever. I squirmed free and held her for a bit. Once it felt right to go back to the story, I said,
How long did Osa and Esma remain locked up in that room before it happened?
2 days.
2 days?
The pedestal assumed that the place was booby-trapped, and or that there might be other Veilers lurking in it. But they had to do something since the hostages were running out of air. It was either that or watch their people die on the Spiele.
So they were scared to death.
Yes,
Ayla said.
I think so. Maybe shocked is a better word. Because they had thought for a while that they had us locked down in Tredegar, which they had infiltrated. Then you and your friends unmasked Jules Verne Durand, so they lost their eyes and ears on the ground. At the same moment, the Convox and all of the other big consents dispersed into the anti-swarm.
That was a great idea. Who dreamed that up? She blushed and fought back a smile, but wasn't happy with my turning the attention to her, so went on.
They are really afraid of the Thousanders, the Encanters, and must have noticed that all of the Millenarian Maths had been emptied out. Where did all of those Thousanders go? What are they cooking up?
Then the 200 missile launch. Very upsetting. A lot of data to process. Zillions of bogeys to track. They think they see a ship. It blows up. They think they've dodged a bullet.
But a few days after that, out of nowhere comes this horrifying and devastating attack on their biggest strategic asset. For 2 days afterwards, it is all that they can think of. They are worried sick about the hostages trapped in that vertex. Not only that, but some other dudes in black suits managed to gain entry to the ship and are only foiled because they can't breathe the air.
They mistook us for another squad of Veilers?
What would you think in their place? And the biggest concern of all in their minds, I believe, was that they couldn't know how many others were out there. For all they knew, there were 100 more of you on the way, with more weapons. So the result of it all was that
they decided to negotiate.
Yes. To initiate four-way talks among the Pedestal, the Fulcrum, and the Magisteria.
Pardon me, what was that last one?
The Magisteria.
Meaning?
This happened after you left Arb. One Magisterium is the secular power. The other is the Mathic world, now the Anti-Swarm. The two of them together are, well,
running the world?
You could say that.
She shrugged.
Until we come up with a better system, anyway.
And would you, Ayla, be one of those people who is currently running the world?
I'm here, aren't I?
She didn't appreciate my humor.
As part of the delegation?
A wall crawler, an aide. And the only reason I made the cut was that the military likes me. They think I'm cool.
I was about to point out a much better explanation, which was that she had been responsible for sending Cell 317 on a successful mission, but she read it on my face and glanced away. She didn't want to hear it mentioned.
There are 4 dozen of us, she said hurriedly. We brought doctors, oxygen.
Food?
Of course.
How did you get here?
Geometers came down and picked us up. Once we reached the Daban Ernud, we came straight here, of course.
I reflected. Shouldn't have brought up the subject of food.
Are you hungry?
She asked. as if it were astonishing that I would be. Obviously.
Why didn't you say so? We brought 5 hampers of absolutely the best food for you guys.
Why 5?
1 for each of you. Not counting Jules, of course. He's been stuffing his face since he got here.
Just to prove I don't have brain damage, would you name the 5, please?
You, Leo, Jessery, Arcibald, and Saman.
And what of Jad? She was so aghast that my social instincts got the better of my brain, and I backed down. Sorry, Ayla. I've been through a lot of weird stuff. My memory is a little blurry.
No, I'm sorry, she said. Maybe it is a result of the trauma.
She looked a little quivery, scrunched her face, mastered it.
Why? What trauma? Of seeing him float away, knowing what happened to him.
When did I see him float away?
Well, he never regained consciousness after the 200 missile launch, Ayla said softly. You saw him collide with a payload. He got stuck to it. You made the decision to go after him, to try to help, but it was tricky. The grapnel missed. You were running out of time. Arcibald was coming to help, but then you nearly got sideswiped by the nuke. Jad drifted away, re-entered the atmosphere, and burned up over Arb.
Oh, yeah, I said. How could I have forgotten? I said it sarcastically, of course, but I was carefully watching Ayla's face as I did. The circumstances of my recent life were such that I was more exquisitely attuned to Ayla's facial expressions than to anything else in the 5 known cosmi. She believed, better, she knew, that what she had just reminded me of was true. There were, I was sure, records down on Arb to prove it.
Retter. A legendary figure associated in folklore with Procyon orders, said to have the power of altering the past by manipulating memories and other physical records. The Dictionary, 4th edition, AR 3000.
All I could think of was getting to the food. First, though, I had to stop being naked. Ayla slipped out as though it were perfectly all right to see me nude, but watching me dress would be indecent. The Arbran delegation had brought us bolts and cords and spheres. The 4 geometer races were more or less fascinated by the avowed, and might take it the wrong way if we attempted to hide what we were. Once I got properly wrapped, the hospital staff helped me don a backpack carrying a tank of Arb oxygen that was connected to the tube beneath my nose. Then I followed a series of pictographic signs to a terrace on the roof of the hospital, where I found Leo and Jessery elbow deep in their hampers. Frau Sildonik was there. With a resigned and hopeless air, he cautioned me not to eat too fast, lest I get sick. I ignored him as heartily as my fraws were doing. After a few minutes, I actually managed to lift my gaze from my bowl and look out at the artificial world around me. The 4 orbs of a given stack were so close that they almost kissed and were linked by portals, a little bit like cars on a passenger train. When the Daben Ernud was maneuvering or accelerating, the portals had to be closed and dogged shut, but they were open today. Loterans lived in orbs 9 through 12. The hospital was in 10, not far from the portal that joined it to 11. This rooftop terrace, like all other outdoor surfaces, was intensely cultivated. A bit of space had been cleared for tables and benches. The tops of these, though, were slabs of glass, and vegetables grew in trays underneath. Bowers arched over our heads, supporting vines laden with clusters of green fruit. As long as one maintained focus on what was near to hand, it looked like a garden on Arb. But the long view was different. The hospital consisted of 6 houseboats lashed together. Each had 3 stories below the waterline and 3 above. Flexible gangways linked them to one another and to neighboring houseboats, which spread across the water to form a circular mat that seemed to cover every square foot of the water's surface. But because gravity here was a fiction created by spin, the surface, what our inner ears or a plumb bob would identify as level, was curved. So the circular mat of boats was dished into a trough. Our inner ears told us that we were at its lowest point. If we gazed across it to the other side, rather less than a mile away, our eyes gave us the alarming news that the water was above us. But if we were to make the journey blindfolded, it would feel like walking over level ground. We'd have no sense of climbing uphill. Of the orb's inner surface, about half was underwater. The remainder constituted the sky. This was blue and had a sun in it. The blue was painted on, but it was possible to forget this unless you looked at the portals to orbs 11 and 9. These hung in the firmament like very strange astronomical bodies and were linked by cable chair systems to houseboats below. The sun was a bundle of optical fibers bringing processed and filtered light that had been harvested by parabolic horns on the exterior of the icosahedron. The fibers were fixed in place on the ceiling of the orb, but by routing the light to different fibers at different times of day, they created the illusion that the sun was moving across the sky. At night, it got dark, but as Jules had explained, fiber pipes were hard routed to indoor growing facilities in the cellars of many houseboats so that plants could grow around the clock. The system was so productive that these geometers were capable of sustaining a population density like that of a moderately crowded city solely on what was produced in the city itself. It was good, in a way, that the view from the hospital roof afforded so many remarkable things to look at and talk about, because otherwise the conversation would have been paralyzingly awkward. Leo's and Jessery's faces were stiff. Oh, they had cracked huge smiles when they had seen me, and I could not have been happier to see them. We shared those feelings immediately and without words. But then their faces had closed up like fists, as much as forbidding me to say anything out loud. We were eating too hard to talk much anyway. Fra Sildonic and another Arbran medic kept coming and going, and though I didn't wish to think ill of our Lateran hosts, I had no way of knowing whether this terrace might be wired with listening devices. Half of the Laterans were pro-pedestal. Even the pro-fulcrum ones, though, might not take kindly to the role we had played in assaulting the Daben Ernud. Some might have had friends or relatives who had been slain by the Veilers. To divulge in casual conversation that a Thousander had breached the hull and then vanished would be the worst possible thing that could happen right now. Once I had sated my hunger a little bit, I began to get physically anxious about it. When Arcibald showed up and made for his hamper like a piece of earth-moving equipment, I waited until his mouth was crammed before raising my glass and saying, "To Fra Jad, even as we think of the four Veilers who died, let's not forget the one who sacrificed his life in the first 10 minutes of the mission, before he even made it out of Arb's atmosphere." "To the late Fra Jad," Jessery echoed, so quickly and forcefully that I knew he must be thinking along similar lines. "I'll never be able to erase the memory of his fiery plunge into the atmosphere," Leo added with a patently fake sincerity that almost made me blow the libation out of my nose. I was keeping an eye on Arcibald, who had stopped chewing and was staring at us, eyes abulge, trying to make out if this was some kind of extremely dark and elaborate humor. I caught his eye and glanced up, an old signal from Edhar, where we would, by a flick of the eyes at the Warden Regulance windows, say, "Shut up and play along." He nodded, letting me know he had taken my meaning, but the look on his face made his shock and confusion plain. I shrugged as a way of letting him know he was in good company. Saman showed up, dressed in the traditional Eda costume, and showing remarkable self-control, went around and shook our hands and gave each of us a squeeze or pat on the shoulder before tearing open his hamper, full of infinitely better and spicier-smelling foods than anything we had. We let him eat. He went about this in the same quiet, contemplative style I had once grown used to, watching him take his lunches on the top of the pinnacle at Edhar. His face showed no curiosity as to why there were 5 people and 5 hampers, instead of some other number. In fact, he was altogether reserved and impassive, which, combined with his formal Eda garb, stirred up all sorts of old habits and social conventions
that had long since settled to the bottom of my consciousness. "Earlier we were raising a toast to the memory of the late Fra Jad and the others who died," I told him, when he paused in his eating and reached for his glass. He gave a curt nod, raised the glass, and said,
"Very well, to our departed comrades."
"Yes, I know too."
"Am I the only one who suffers from funny neurological sequelae?"
Archibald asked, still a bit rattled.
"You mean brain damage?"
Jessery asked in a helpful tone.
"That would depend on whether it is as permanent as what ails you,"
Archibald fired back.
"Some of my memories are a little sketchy,"
Leo offered. Saman cleared his throat and glared at him.
"But the longer I'm awake, the more coherent I seem to get,"
Leo added. Saman returned his focus to the food. Jules Verne Durand stopped by, took in the scene, and beamed.
"Ah," he exclaimed, "when I saw the five of you out of your spacesuits gasping for air like beached fish in the observatory, I feared I would never be able to look on a scene such as this one."
We all raised glasses his way and beckoned for him to join us.
"What of the others? I mean, what was done with the four corpses?"
Jessery asked. Five sets of auburn eyes went to the Lateran's face. But if Jules noted any discrepancy in the figures, he didn't show it.
"This became a topic of negotiation," Jules said. "The bodies of the four Veilers have been frozen. As you can guess, there are those of the pedestal who wish to dissect them as biological specimens."
A cloud passed over his face, and he paused for a few moments. We all knew he was remembering his wife, Lise, whose body had been subjected to the biological specimen treatment at the Convox. After getting his poise back, he went on.
"The diplomats of Arb have said in the strongest terms that this would be unacceptable, that the remains are to be treated as sacred and handed over, undisturbed, to this delegation of which you are now a part. This will occur at the opening ceremonies, which are to take place in Orb 4 in about 2 hours.
The pedestal doesn't know yet about the everything killers lodged in your bodies, and I haven't spilled the beans, but it's really making me nervous." Had even more everything killers been brought up by the delegation? Were hundreds, thousands of them now salted around the Dabinurnud? Were there some in the delegation who had the power to trigger them? I remembered, if that was the right word, for something that had not happened in this cosmos, the silver box in Fra Jad's hand, the detonator. Who of the four dozen were carrying them? More to the point, who would press the trigger? To a certain kind of mind, this would make for an acceptable trade. At the cost of 4 dozen Arbran lives, the Dabinurnud would be sterilized, or at least crippled to the point where its survivors would have no choice but to surrender unconditionally. Much cheaper than fighting a war with them. For more than one reason, I was no longer hungry. Everyone else was thinking similar thoughts, and so conversation was not exactly sparkling. In fact, it was non-existent. The silence became conspicuous. I wondered what a blind visitor would think of the place, for the sonic environment was distinctly odd. The air didn't move much in these orbs. Each was warmed and cooled on a different diurnal schedule so that the expanding and contracting air would slosh back and forth through the portals and stir faint breezes down below. But it never blew hard enough to raise waves, or even to blow a leaf from a table. Sound carried in that still air, and it ricocheted strangely from the ceiling of the orb. We heard someone rehearsing a tricky passage on a bowed instrument, children arguing, a group of women laughing, an air-powered tool cycling. The air felt dense, the place closed in, deadening, stifling. Or perhaps that was just the food catching up with me.
"Orb 4 is Ernudin," Leo finally said, waking us all up.
"Yes," Jules said heavily, "and all of you will be there."
"Nothing personal, but I want you walking bombs out of my orb as soon as possible."
"It is the highest numbered of the Ernudin orbs," Archibald observed, "meaning, if I understand the convention, the farthest aft, the most residential, the,
Lowest in the hierarchy, yes, said Jules. The oldest, the most important stuff, the highest in the command, are in Orb 1. That's the one you'd want to nuke.
Will we be visiting Orb 1?
Leo asked. Are we going to have an opportunity to nuke it?
I would be astonished, said Jules. The people there are very strange and hardly ever come out.
We all looked at each other.
Yes, said Jules. They are a little like your Thousanders.
Fitting, said Arcibald, since their journey has lasted for 1,000 years.
It is doubly unfortunate the Fraudjad perished during the launch then, I said, since Orb 1 sounds like a place he would make a beeline for. That is, in a narrative where he had made it here with someone like me to open doors for him.
What do you imagine he'd do once he reached it? Asked Jessery, keenly interested.
Well, it depends on what kind of reception we got when we came in the door, I pointed out. If things went badly wrong, we would not survive, and our consciousnesses would no longer track that narrative.
Saman chopped this off by clearing his throat again.
How long will it take for us to get from here to Orb 4? Jessery asked.
I think he was the only one capable of speech. Leo and Arcibald were gobsmacked.
We should leave as soon as convenient, Jules replied. An advance party is already there.
Everything killers are already in Orb 4. Nothing can be done about it. We began wrapping up our food, repacking our hampers.
How many Orth interpreters are there? Arcibald asked.
Do we get to hang out with you?
With my level of skill, there is only I.
I'm about to become extremely busy. I won't be able to talk to you after this.
What kind of people make up the Arbran delegation?
Leo asked. Who's got his finger on the everything killer's trigger?
Quite a funny mix, if you ask me. Leaders of arcs, entertainers, captains of commerce, philanthropists such as Magnith Forl, Avout, Eta, citizens, including a couple well known to you.
This was directed at me.
You're kidding,
I said, momentarily forgetting about all of the grim subtext.
Cordon Yule?
He nodded.
Because of their role during the visitation of Orithena, watched by so many on the Spili that you, Saman, put on the reticulum, it was seen as fitting that they come here, as representatives of the people.
The politicians are pimping them to the mass media.
Understood, said Leo. But among all of those pop singers and witch doctors, there must be at least some actual representatives of the secular power.
4 of the military, who strike me as honorable.
Not the ones who will trigger the EKs.
10 of the government, including our old friend, Madam Secretary.
Those Forls really get around,
I couldn't help saying. Saman raised an eyebrow at me. Jules went on to rattle off a list of the names and titles of the secular power contingent, going out of his way to identify some of them as mere aides.
And finally, our old friend, Emon Beldo, to whom, I sense, there is more than meets the eye.
He's the one. Whatever praxis would be used to trigger the EKs, it would be advanced, possibly nothing more than a prototype. It would have to be disguised as something innocuous. They would need someone like Emon to operate it, and he would take his orders from, presumably, the highest-ranking Pandrandrum in the delegation, not Ignatha Forl. She was here on lineage business, of that I had no doubt. Whatever her nominal title and brief might be in the secular power, she and her cousin, or whatever he was, Magnath, had not come all this way to follow the whims of whatever Pandrandrum happened to have most lately gained the upper hand in the infinite clown fight that was secular politics. Did the Forls know about Fra Jad? Were they working with him? Had they framed a plan together during our stay at Elkhazg? There was so much to think about that my mind shut off, and all I did for the better part of the next half hour was take in new sensations. I had turned into Artisan Flex Spielecaptor, all eyes, no brain. With my eagle res, my steady hand, and my dynazoom, I dumbly watched and recorded our discharge from the hospital.
paperwork, it seemed, was one of those protic attractors that remained common and unchanged across all Cosmi. We were given over into the care of a squad of 5 nose-tube-wearing Troans in the same get-ups as the goons who had assaulted me and Jad in my dream. Hallucination, or alternate polycosmic incarnation. Leo ogled their weapons, which tended toward sticks, aerosol cans, and electrical devices. Apparently high-energy projectiles were frowned on in a pressurized environment. They gave us a good-looking over in return, paying special attention to Leo. They'd been doing research on who was who, and some of the Valor mystique had rubbed off on him. 2 of the soldiers and Jules went ahead of us. 3 followed. We crossed a gangplank into someone's garden, and I looked through an open window from arm's length away at a Lateran man washing dishes. He ignored me. From there, we crossed into a school playground. The kids stopped playing for a few moments and watched us go by. Some said hello. We smiled, bowed, and returned the greeting. This went over well. From there, we crossed to a houseboat where a couple of women were transplanting vegetables. And so it went. The community did not waste space on streets. Their transportation system was a network of rights of way thrown over the roofs and terraces of the houseboats. Anyone could walk anywhere, and a social convention dictated that people simply ignore each other. Heavy goods were moved around on skinny, deep-draft gondolas, maneuvering through narrow leads of open water, whose existence came as a surprise because they tunneled under flexible bowers and so, from the hospital terrace, had looked only like dark green veins and arteries ramifying through the town. In a few minutes, we came to a boat that served as the terminal of the cable chair system. We rowed up to the hole in the sky, 2 by 2, each Arbran accompanied by a Troan soldier, until all had collected in the portal that joined 10 to 11. The wind was blowing in our faces strongly enough to sting our eyes and whip our bolts around. While waiting for the others to catch up, I stood in the portal and looked at the theatrical machinery behind the blue scrim of the fake sky, the bundles of glass fibers that piped in the light. The sun was bright but cold. All the infrared had been filtered out of it. Warmth came instead from the sky itself, which radiated gentle heat like an extremely low-temperature broiler. We felt it strongly here and were glad of the wind. Then another chair ride down to Orb 11's houseboat mat, a walk across, and a similar ride up to the next portal, and into Orb 12, the highest numbered, farthest aft of the 4 Lateran orbs. Hence, there was no next portal. We had reached the caboose. But the sky supported a tubular catwalk cum ladder that took us up and around to a portal in the highest part of the sky, the zenith. Gravity here was noticeably weaker because we were closer to the core. We tarried on the ring-shaped catwalk below the portal, which, down to the last rivet, was just like the one in Orb 1 where Fra Jad had taken a shotgun blast. I looked around and saw details I clearly remembered, and I perched my butt on the railing to check it against my memory of being knocked over it. Jules had to identify himself at a Spiele terminal and state his business to someone in a language that I assumed was Ernudin. The leader of the soldiers chimed in with bursts of gruff talk. We 5 had to take turns standing in front of the machine and have our faces scanned. While we waited, we examined the ball valve, which felt, and therefore looked, as if it were in the ceiling, straight above our heads. It was old hat to me. In its design, I recognized the massive, thunderous praxic style, call it heavy intercosmic or Newton space bunker, that dominated the look of the ship as seen from the outside and the core, but was mercifully absent from the orbs. That great steel eye would not open for us today. Instead, we would use a round hatch just wide enough to admit Arcibald, or a Troan grunt in his cumbrous gear web. This eventually swung open by remote command, and we queued up to climb through it. "A threat," Jesri snorted, and nodded at the colossal ball valve. I knew his tone, disgusted that he'd been so long figuring it out. I must have looked baffled. "Come on," he said. "Why would a Praxic design it that way? Why use a ball valve instead of some other kind? A ball valve works even when there is a large pressure difference between its 2 sides," I said.
So the command could evacuate the core, open it to space, and then open this valve and kill the whole orb. Is that what you're thinking? Jessery nodded.
Fra Jessery, your explanation is unreasonably cynical, said Arcibald,
who had been listening.
Oh, I'm sure there are other reasons for it, Jessery said, but it is a threat all the same.
One by one we ascended a ladder through the small side hatch, up a short vertical tube, and through a second hatch, an airlock, and collected on another ring catwalk on the bore of the vertical shaft that rose 1,200 feet above us to the core. I checked out the keypad. Just where I remembered it. Leo had passed through first and was donning a sort of padded blindfold. Jules handed them to the rest of us as we emerged from the airlock.
Why?
I asked sharply.
So you don't get sick from the effects of Coriolis, he said. But in case you do,
and he handed me a bag.
Come to think of it, take two, the way you are eating.
I took a last look up before putting on the blindfold. We were getting ready to ascend a dauntingly tall ladder, but I knew that gravity would get weaker the higher we went, so it wouldn't be that arduous. We would, however, be experiencing powerful, disorienting inertial effects as we moved closer to the axis, hence the concern about motion sickness. I groped for the lowest rung.
Slow, Jules said. Settle on each step and wait for it to feel correct before moving to the next.
Since the whole ladder was enclosed in a tubular cage, there was scant danger of falling. I took the rung slowly as recommended, listening for movement from Leo, who was above me, before going to the next. But above a certain point, the rungs became mostly symbolic. A flick of the wrist or finger floated us to the next one up. Still, the Troan soldier at the top maintained the same steady pace. He had learned the hard way that those who climbed too fast would soon be reaching for their bags. I was thinking about that keypad. What if Fra Jad had punched in one of the 9,999 wrong numbers? What if he had attempted it several times? Eventually, a red light would have gone on in some security bunker. They'd have turned on a spelecaptor and seen a live feed of two firefighters screwing around with the keypad. They'd have sent someone to shoo them off. That person probably would not have been issued a shotgun, just the non-lethal weapons that our escorts were toting. Jessery's words came back to me. A threat. He was right. Opening that ball valve had been a way of putting a gun to the head of the whole orb. No wonder those soldiers had simply rushed up and blown us away. In a cosmos where Fra Jad knew or guessed the number on the keypad, we were sure to get killed. Freeing me, apparently, to end up somewhere else. But what would have happened in all of the vastly more numerous cosmi where he had punched in the wrong random number? We would have been taken alive. What would have happened next in those cosmi? We'd have been detained for a while, then taken to parley with Gan Odru. My ears told me I had emerged from the top of the shaft. My hand pawed in the air but didn't find a next rung. Instead, the Troan intercepted it, hauled me out, hauled back the other way to kill the momentum he had conferred on me, and guided me to something I could grab. I peeled up my blindfold and saw that I had emerged into the core. The ball valve leading to the aft-bearing chamber was just a stone's throw behind us. Its length in the other direction was inestimable, but I knew it to be 2.25 miles. It was as I remembered it. Glowing tubes strung down its inner surface emitted filtered sunlight, and the conveyor belt ran endlessly with well-looped clicking and humming noises. 3 other well shafts were plumbed into the core at this nexus. The one directly above or opposite us led into Orb 4. It looked like a direct, straight-line continuation of the shaft we had just finished climbing. A ring ladder ran around the core wall, providing access to all of them. Those who were practiced at this kind of thing could simply jump across. There was a wait. To begin with, those below me on the ladder had to catch up. Moreover, a traffic jam had already developed in the shaft to Orb 4. There were safety rules governing how many were allowed to use the ladder at once, being enforced by a soldier stationed at the top rung, Some other delegation was going down ahead of us, though from our point of view they appeared to be ascending the ladder feet first, and we would have to wait until they had reached the bottom. So, Leo and I began screwing around. We decided to see if we could make ourselves motionless in the center of the core. The goal was to place oneself near the middle of the big tunnel while killing one's spin so that the whole ship would rotate around one's body. This had to be done through some combination of jumping off from the wall just so and then swimming in the air to make adjustments. Desperately clumsy would be a fair description of our first 5 minutes' efforts. From there we moved on to dangerously incompetent, as while flailing around, I kicked Leo in the face and gave him a bloody nose. The Troan soldiers watched with mounting amusement. They couldn't understand a word we were saying, but they knew exactly what we were trying to do. After I kicked Leo, they took pity on us, or perhaps they were just scared that we'd get seriously hurt and they'd be blamed. One of them beckoned me over. He grabbed my cord in one hand and my bolt at the scruff of my neck at the other and gave me a gentle push combined with a little torque. When I swam to a halt in the middle of the tunnel, I saw I was closer than I had ever been to achieving the goal. Hearing voices in Fluckish, I looked up the core to see a contingent of perhaps 24 coming to join us. Most were floating down the middle of the core instead of using the conveyors, so even if they hadn't been speaking Fluckish, I'd have known them for tourists. One of these suddenly bounded ahead of the group, drawing a rebuke from a soldier. Cord hand-over-handed her way along the tunnel wall and launched herself at me from 100 feet away. I feared the impending collision, but fortunately air resistance slowed her flight, so that when we banged bodies it was no more violent than walking into someone. We had a long zero-gravity hug. Another Arbran was not far behind her, a young secular man. I didn't recognize him, but I had the oddest feeling that I was expected to. He was slowly tumbling on all three axes as he drifted toward me and my Sib, flailing his arms and legs as if that would help. For that, he was very impressively dressed and coiffed. One of our soldier escorts reached out and gave him a push on the knee that stopped his tumbling and slowed his trajectory to something not quite so meteoric. He came to a near stop with respect to me and Cord. Gazing at him past Cord's right ear, which was pressed so hard against my cheek that I was pretty sure her earrings were drawing blood, I saw him raise a spelecaptor and draw a bead on us. "In the chilly heart of the alien starship," he intoned in a beautifully modulated baritone, "a heartwarming reunion between brother and sister. Cord, the secular half of the heroic pair, shows profound relief as she—" I was just beginning to have some profound but not quite so heartwarming emotions of my own when the man with the spelecaptor was somehow, almost magically, replaced by Ulessitar Crade. Associated with the miracle were a few sound effects, a meaty thwomp and a sharp exhalation, a sort of bark from the man with the spelecaptor. Yule had simply launched himself at the guy from some distance away and body-checked him at full speed, stopping on a dime in midair as he transferred all of his energy into the target.
"Conservation of momentum," he announced. "It's not just a good idea, it's the law."
Far away, I heard a thud and a squawk as the man with the hairdo impacted on the end cap. This was almost drowned out, though, by chuckling and what I took to be appreciative commentary from our soldier escorts. If I'd been startled at first to learn that Ulessitar Crade had been made part of all things, a diplomatic legation, I saw the genius of it now.